Thank you for listening to the article podcast from the UBS Art Advisory Team in the United States, which guides individuals and families toward best practices and principles to build, maintain, and plan for exceptional, lasting collections. My name is Matthew Newton, UBS Art Advisory Specialist for the U.S., and host of these podcasts, in which UBS will share insights from practitioners in the art and collectibles world. While my guests and I sometimes discuss services and capabilities that they and their organizations provide, please note that UBS has no formal affiliation with any of our guests or their organizations, and in no way is UBS promoting or endorsing our guests or their organizations. Thank you for listening to the article podcast from the UBS Art Advisory in the United States. My name is Matthew Newton, UBS Art Advisory Specialist. The audience for this conversation is the family office clients of UBS and their financial advisors. And today we're going to talk about all things related to fine art insurance policies so we can all be better informed about how to care for our collections that we hold so dearly. And I'm delighted to have Brad Taylor from Hub International join me today at the UBS U.S. headquarters on Avenue of the Americas in New York City. Brad currently serves as president of personal lines and practice leader of the fine art and special risk division with Hub International. I think you have a longer job title than I do there, Brad. He's responsible for the overall management, carrier, and client relations and development of insurance and risk management solutions for the region's personal lines clients, including placement of specialized policies for high net worth individuals, family offices, and individuals with high risk exposures. As the region's fine arts leader, he also works closely with galleries, art collections, museums, nonprofits, and cultural institutions. Brad, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Very excited to be here.
Great. Well, I'm very excited for this conversation. It's probably not, you know, the top of everyone's list as the most thrilling topic to talk about insurance, but I have to say it's one of the more fascinating parts of the art world and the art market. So I'm really happy to hear your perspectives on it. And speaking of perspectives, I know that one of the questions we received a lot and was a very big topic over the last several months, and it was obviously on everyone's radar, were the LA wildfires that happened earlier this year. And I'd love to just hear kind of a general overview from you of what you guys saw from that and kind of what you're seeing going forward from here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's something that, as tragic as it was, you know, we're always looking backwards to figure out what we can learn, you know, from an event like that to make sure that we're prepared and we're, you know, advising our clients on how best to prepare going forward. And this was no exception in terms of a lot of lessons learned. So, I would start off by saying, first of all, from a fine art insurance perspective, there was a lot of concern, you know, as the wildfire was continuing to grow and spread about what it would actually impact on the fine art collection side. And I think what we found is that because the fire didn't spread inside of, you know, LA and it didn't go into the Beverly Hills and some of those other neighborhoods, the impact on the true specialty fine art market itself was relatively minimal. While there was definitely some losses, there wasn't a significant amount of large collections in the Palisades and some of the other areas that were really impacted to be able to drive the insurance, fine art insurance marketplace one way or another. You know, there's going to be some tighter underwriting, of course, but I think California, and specifically certain areas of California, were already well known to have a high risk, you know, exposure, you know, from a wildfire perspective. So I don't think it was any surprise. I think the surprise was more how quickly it spread, you know, how, and this is one of the biggest lessons learned, is like what actual evacuation plan and how do you protect your art, you know, when this happens, is like, you know, how does that work? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can have a plan on paper, but that doesn't mean when the time comes to actually execute on it, are you ready? You know, is your staff or your team ready? And like, is it actually executable? You know, or is your, you know, I think a lot of collectors, for better or worse, found that their home was situated in a place that a fire could actually start right next to them. If that's the case, you don't have the time, the time you need to be able to call someone to come get your art and move it away. I mean, you know, they're not going to let anybody in if it's a, you know, completely shut down, you know, emergency zone. And so I think what we found is some differentiation between not only who had a plan and who didn't have a plan, but like based on where they were located, what type of plan they should have. You know, the fire, a wildfire, hopefully, is not going to start in the middle of downtown LA or, you know, in Beverly Hills. It could spread there, but it won't start there. So certain collectors in certain locations, museums, you know, foundations, they're going to just innately have more time to actually react. And then there's the ones that, like, the, you know, that are living more in the brush areas, they're outside of LA, that there's a, you know, likelihood that the fire could start right next to them or on them. And then you have no chance to react. And it's kind of, you know, you have to be prepared to, like, accept that risk and then, you know, not have a plan on paper, but have a plan that's actually going to be executable.
And I imagine that that, you know, when you're making a decision about where to keep your collection, that really goes into your thinking. So if you're building a home in the Pacific Palisades, for example, you know, you're really thinking, like, is this the right home for these works to live in, especially the higher value works, you know, out of the collection?
Yeah. No, and you know, absolutely. But I think what we saw, which is more of a recent trend post-COVID, is a lot of collectors traditionally, even in Florida, didn't have a significant part of their collection itself kept in Florida or even California because it was a secondary home, or even if it was a secondary home or a primary home that they lived in, you know, more than half the year, they still didn't keep their the largest, you know, part of their collection there because they knew that the area itself wasn't necessarily the best atmosphere or environment for different reasons or different risks to keep, you know, a large, you know, meaningful part of their art collection that they personally really cared about and was passionate about. But post-COVID, what we've seen is a lot of folks moving away from urban areas to whether it be Florida or California. You know, there was a little social distancing or, you know, pods and all that. And people wanted to take their the things that they enjoyed the most with them, you know, especially if they're going to be spending even more time there. So we saw a significant shift that we hadn't seen up to that point of collections going from the areas that were more metropolitan and had sort of a built up fine art network of like storage area, storage facilities, packers, shippers like New York, Chicago. And then we saw the art going to more suburban or Florida, you know, homes that there was a risk there, but like the collector was okay with the risk if it meant enjoying the collection day to day versus never seeing it, you know, except three times a year.
And putting you guys to work, I'm sure, is part of that process. But, you know, thinking about that as a family is, let's say they're in the early stages of thinking about a fine art insurance policy. I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective or opinion, like at what value range of a collection does it make sense to start to have a dedicated, you know, fine art insurance policy?
Sure. You know, and this is a question that comes up quite a lot. I don't look at it from a value perspective as much as a collector and where you're going perspective. It's important to have the foundational right program in place, no matter what the collection's at, zero pieces or 1,000 pieces and 100 million or a billion in terms of total value, because you ultimately need to be prepared as that collection grows, whether, you know, it would be, you know, acquiring via traditional auctions or private sales. You know, you need, that needs to be prepared whenever and when to cover whatever, really, as the definition of art has, you know, expanded rapidly. And that, you know, you have to start from scratch. And the farther you go along in the collection journey, the more difficult it is to kind of go backwards, fix, you know, what you have in place, and then continue going, you know, without disrupting the collection or the collecting process itself. And so, I always say, don't think about where you are now. Think about where you're going to be in 12 months, 24 months, 36 months. Because if you do have a plan and you know that you're going to be taking on a meaningful amount of the collection, art collection, or, you know, in terms of activity, if you're a certain type of collector that is going to be buying and selling quite often, you might need a more specialized product. And that's really what you should be focusing on, not where you are now.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So sort of thinking about what amount of money you might be spending or what value you anticipate the collection happening in the future a little bit. Now, some people obviously have that today that are thinking about doing it. But if you anticipate already that you're going to be spending sort of X number of dollars in the future, like go ahead and like have that conversation today around it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen some of the folks that have become wealthy in their lifetime didn't start off as collectors. They didn't have a collection of anything except maybe, you know, some, you know, whatever they got, you know, from working, you know, for, you know, several decades to build up their net worth. And then they've taken on the pursuit of collecting, you know, art or collectibles or memorabilia, and they basically know they're going to go into that intentionally, and, you know, it's part of a plan, and part of the plan should be the insurance from this day one.
So, you know, some clients choose to have their art collection as part of their homeowner's policy, and some have it as a distinct fine art policy. I'm curious if you could kind of break out for us, like, when do you think it's appropriate possibly to think about those two categories?
Yeah. There's several insurance carriers who also insure homes who have, you know, wonderful capabilities as it relates to art. I think when you look at what they can offer, and certainly some of the other more standard insurance carriers that also can just throw on some valuables or art to the homeowner's policies, like a rider, you know, what you're getting from a specialized or, you know, separate dedicated fine art product is flexibility, the ability to customize the policy to your the specific collector's needs, wants, you know, buying, selling, and like items that they're actually going after, and making sure that it fits them. It's not an off-the-shelf product. It's really built around them, who they are as a collector, and their collection itself, ideally to respond in real time to the fluctuation in values. So that, you know, and a lot of these policies that are covering art that's, you know, like an add-on to the homeowner's policy, you know, it has a stated value, and then you can update it once a year, or, you know, you maybe you'll get around to it once a year. But the truth is, if you're an active collector, with the art market being as dynamic as it is, once a year and updating the values isn't quite enough. You know, you really, I mean, you know, things can change quite dramatically in terms of values, you know, even day to day or week to week or, you know, season to season. And so you need a policy that wants to, you know, respond in real time to protect your assets that you care about.
Interesting. So another question that comes up frequently is this idea of like when to itemize a policy. It's like a list out individual works and when to more just have kind of an umbrella that covers them all. You know, when do you think are the appropriate fits for collectors?
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, comes up quite often. Insurance is important. You know, we're very passionate about it, and we believe that it serves a purpose and, you know, really driving the art market forward. But at the same time, it shouldn't be the singular focus of a collector, you know, constantly adding and subtracting and removing items from their insurance policy when they should be focusing on what artwork and artists they should be, you know, looking at and spending time with. And so the administrative burden of scheduling items versus blanket, you know, having a blanket, you know, is important. But it also is just as important, or more important really, is, you know, what you're expecting out of your insurance policy in terms of valuation. You know, the benefits of having a scheduled value is you get certainty on, at a minimum, what that item will be worth from the insurance carrier's perspective in the event of a loss, both partial and total. So you have a starting point. You know, blanket, which is generally going to be valued at the current fair market value at time of loss, is, you know, is somewhat subjective. I mean, you're going to have to demonstrate and get the insurance carrier to basically, you know, agree that this was the fair market value of the item at time of loss. So there's that extra step, you know, once a claim happens on a blanket policy that doesn't exist with a scheduled value program. And then, you know, if you have the right policy, the scheduled value fine art policy will also give you the benefit of the market appreciation above and beyond scheduled value. So you can, you know, claim that as well. But at least you get some certainty on the scheduled value. I look at a collection, look at the number of pieces, look at the activity, but you also look at the types of artists they're collecting. You know, if they're if it's an emerging or the smaller valued items, which traditionally would fall under a blanket limit, are more emerging artists, or there's potential for, you know, dramatic increase in values quickly. You know, you may want to schedule those items because a blanket value. Our blanket value may be subject to a smaller limit that may not be adequate if that artist actually does, you know, increase in value quickly. And so it kind of, it really depends on the items, how many items you got, and then where's the right point that you kind of cadence you want to focus on, you know, getting scheduled value versus blanket.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's a matter kind of a question of, are you more willing to take on the administrative task of listing all this out, getting the appraised values, that sort of thing, on the front end of the policy, or doing it more on the back end at a time of loss? I mean, that seems like a big consideration for it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Having the carrier accept and agree to the value up front before a claim removes that step and removes, you know, potentially contentious, you know, discussion if there's a value that, you know, you've got in mind as a collector versus, you know, what the, you know, insurance carrier is, you know, willing to accept. You know, you've got certainty, which is, I mean, big part of insurance and why you're paying for it, certainly to respond to claims. But if you don't have claims, which I think we all hope you don't, anyone doesn't, peace of mind.
Right.
You know, and then that, if you're paying for, if you want peace of mind, I mean, scheduled value is what you get more than a blanket.
So thinking of, you brought up kind of the valuations, which is obviously a central importance, you know, when thinking about an insurance policy. So I'm curious to hear from your perspective about the role of appraisals in that process. How often should they be done? Who should collectors be thinking to hire for them? And sort of how do you guys look at that part of the process?
Yeah, absolutely. And I always say that the valuation component of a fine art insurance policy is the most important part of the insurance policy, because that's going to determine what ultimately you get. The limit is what the insurance carrier will actually pay up to total. But the valuation is what, you know, portion of the policy is like, it's going to determine what you're going to actually get regardless of the limit. And so, we always focus on that and making sure that it is, you know, carefully customized to the collector itself in terms of the collection and how the values are determined. So you talk about appraisers, and there's a lot of wonderful appraisers out there. Can be one part of a broader valuation methodology depending on the collector itself. So I look at the collection, you look at like the types of artists, the pieces, you know, what periods they're coming from, and like, you know, how those values are, you know, typically, you know, moving over a certain amount of time. I mean, you know, the possibility of a more stable old master type collection to be going up 3-4 times, you know, in 1 year is less likely than an emerging artist, you know, modern contemporary, where you see those sort of huge swings in values. And so I think the amount of appraisals that, you know, the cadence of appraisals that you're going to be, you know, should be getting is going to be dependent on the type of collection, but also what other resources does that collector have that they're more comfortable with to determine the value. Because the insurance carriers don't, at least the specialty finer insurance carriers, don't only accept appraisals, you know, in terms of agreeing to values. There's other just as, accepted sources of valuation on artwork that like the insurance carriers will accept, you know, as well. And so, you know, often with a 1,000-piece collection, the collector may not want a appraiser going in and, you know, determining the value across the entire collection every few years, because it's administratively time, cost, you know, all kind of take up. But there's other areas that collector may be able to tap into that give confidence to the insurance carrier to agree to the values that they want.
You're thinking of like maybe invoices, that type of document for that?
Well, it could be original, you know, invoices and sales prices, you know, if it was bought in the recent past. But also, you know, gallerists, there's a number of very well-established and very reputable fine art advisors that the insurance carriers will accept their perspective on values for individual items. There's also, you know, artist foundations and other resources or reference points that the insurance – and, there, you know, there's also, while not totally accepted by the insurance carrier community yet, growing interest in some of the technology tools around, art prices and, you know, market valuation type tools and softwares that, like, you know, those could be accepted, you know, in the future at some point as well by insurance carriers. Although I don't think that any insurance carrier that I know of yet is quite – using them fully to establish and, you know, determine values on artwork.
That's very interesting. So it sort of sounds like if you're willing to bootstrap it a little bit and go out and kind of make the calls and determine the valuation some and back it up from certain kinds of art world professionals, you could do that or hire an licensed appraiser to do that part for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean certain collectors who have large collections are constantly in the art market and are to some extent impacting the art market values themselves. And so they probably are the right experts to determine values on certain items.
That's interesting. Just as a quick side note, we often talk about that, this idea that, you know, collectors who become very established. I encourage this among our clients to really think of themselves as very active participants in the art market in that sense, because a lot of times the most successful collectors end up being just as much experts in the work that they collect as any other art world professionals out there, which I think is just kind of fascinating. Transitioning slightly, appraisals, obviously, you know, the valuation of the collection, this all ties very specifically into how much the insurance policy costs, which of course is an important, you know, consideration. I think that, you know, a lot of collectors, when they're thinking about the price of an artwork, you know, there's the price you pay, but then there's also the prices that you pay to keep the work over time, you know, which is a little bit different than maybe other kinds of assets that one might purchase. So fee structure, I was hoping to talk about that a little bit with you in terms of just, you know, and I know we're talking about kind of rule of thumb sort of categories here, but typical price range or percentage of collection value, something like that, you could kind of give a framework for people that might be approaching this topic for the first time?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very difficult because each collection is a little bit different, and the actual price that a collector is going to be paying is going to be dependent on a few different things, whether they've had any fine art losses in the last few years or in recent memory. The activity of the collection itself. So, 90% of the claims that we see on the fine art side are driven by items being moved. Mm. So, whether it be artwork that's on loan, consignment, being moved around the home, or being displayed in some other way that requires it to be pack shipped, and that is where we see the majority of damage being caused by. And that does, to some extent, from an underwriter's perspective, drive the rate as well. A collection that is sitting in a home that never moves, all else equal, should have a lower rate than a collection that is consistently being loaned out to different museums, exhibitions, and is constantly, out there, even if they're taking the best possible, protections and using all the right vendors with packing, shipping, and everything else, there is still a risk of damage, even if everyone's doing everything the way that, not should be, but maybe using the right people that you should. They can still make mistakes, and humans are humans, and we see it all the time, for better or worse. And so there's that. Obviously the location is critical. So the rate in Florida, the rate in New York, the rate in Wisconsin, rate in California, all going to be very different. And then they're also looking at what type of collector is it? They're really, and I think that the best fine art insurance underwriters and brokers are really understanding the intent of the collection, the DNA behind the collector itself. What's driving them? In terms of pursuing this, passion, is it purely financial gain? And then you're kind of, if so, then you need to modify the insurance policy to anticipate that income, or profit that the collector is looking to have, and will drive the price versus somebody that is more looking at it from an preserving humanity's treasures for the next generation, really not looking for loss in value in the event of a claim, but more just looking to keep the items, in a relatively good condition or restoration, in the event of damage, and that will go into the pricing as well. And so, it's tough to give you a exact range. I can tell you that when you look at the amount of value that some collections have versus the price of insurance, I think the economics clearly make sense to buy the insurance because it's balance sheet protection, and it is on a percentage basis a small amount relative to the total value of the collection. And so, I'm not a gambler. I think if you're going to look at it from an odds perspective, it's a good bet to take.
Spoken like a true insurance salesman. That was great.
Well, listen, I like to think that we don't sell anything. We're here to advise, and hopefully, we can add some value to any collector or museum or anybody continuing to pursue items of value. And a collector never stops collecting, and I looked at, maybe we're like collectors of insurance policies, and we are very passionate about the space, but we're also driven by helping our clients. I mean, that's really why we do this all day in, day and out. Now, there's nothing that gives us better satisfaction and validation than having a client who's protected for something and has unforeseen circumstances or loss, but also giving peace of mind for people.
So you brought up in that last sort of round the idea that, most 90% or whatever that number might be of the claims happening around the art being moved in one way or another.
Yeah.
And so I was hoping you might give a little bit more, color to that. And what – I guess if someone is, if you're a collector, you have multiple homes, maybe the artworks are shifting between them, or maybe you are being approached by institutions who want to borrow pieces from your collection, that sort of thing. What should collectors have in mind to make sure they are not in that group or least likely to be in the group that's having a problem?
Right. Yeah, I think the best you can do, if you're being realistic about, the situation where an item is going to be moved, is you can do everything possible to minimize the possibility of damage, but it always exists. Art is fragile by nature. A lot of the art that's out there wasn't made to stand the test of time. And now it's become incredibly valuable in a way that the artists who probably originally made it never, anticipated. And so they didn't really prepare it, to last 100, 200, 300, 400 years. And now we're trying to keep these items around for as long as possible. And so you need to accept the risk that there's a possibility you will get damaged and then plan for that, but also do everything possible to prevent that from happening. Depending on where the item is going, if it's going into somebody else's care, custody, or control for a loan or exhibition or even consignment, you need to make sure that you've got an agreement in place, written agreement with that other party that clearly outlines responsibilities, duties, who's insuring the item, what is, you know, what they're allowed to do or authorized to do in the event of potential damage, cleaning, care, conservation, and also making sure that they notify you within a short amount of time of any potential or actual damage so you're well aware, and then making sure that you have you trust the party, you know, on the other end of that contract. I mean, a contract's only as good as the other person's going to actually abide by the contract. And what we often see, and most often with overseas loans and consignments, is you can have all the contracts and all the lawyers in the world, but if they don't really care, if they're not worried about, you know, the jurisdiction that they're in actually coming back and, you know, kind of doing anything to them, that doesn't matter. What's going to matter is how much they actually care about working with you to keep the item safe, protect the item, and also be a partner if anything does, you know, unforeseen happen, which is incredibly important. And I think that's where we see people get the most frustration, or probably in the place where they wish they hadn't done it, is they relied on, you know, check the box type protections, but they didn't have that relationship. Because, like, you know, having another party care about the item is going to beat anything else they can do. Mm-hmm. I would rather have a mediocre art packer and shipper who really cared about making sure this item is properly secured, packed, shipped, versus the best, most reputable art packer and shipper out there who really didn't care about me.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, that's very helpful to hear. Thank you very much. So I want to kind of shift a little bit to think about a question that comes up a lot. And this really relates back to the beginning of the conversation. We were thinking about Los Angeles. Florida's come up a number of times. You know, we've heard from clients who are having trouble, you know, finding a policy at all for their collection, depending on where they live. And especially as you rightly pointed out, very valuable collections have moved and in some ways consolidated in parts of the country that maybe where they were not before. And so I guess if you're a collector facing a circumstance like that, you know, what are your options? What do you kind of look to do there?
Yeah. I mean, I think that anybody can get a policy likely. It's just a matter of what cost. Mm. And if you have a broker who's approaching the insurance process, you know, the same as they would anywhere else, but in a catastrophic area, especially with a large value collection, you're not going to like the outcome. You can't take the same steps or go through the same motions, you know, on insuring and structuring an insurance program for a fine art collection in Florida as you do in New York or Nebraska, because you're ultimately going to be the end user, the end purchaser of it is going to be paying for a lot of coverage they don't need, but also underinsured in other areas they probably do need. And it's about having, like, value out of the insurance policy and making sure that, like, it makes sense for that collector itself. Because in Florida, I mean, all risks aren't equal. You know, there's a difference between having a collection in a home on the intercoastal, you know, versus having a collection in a newly built condominium building, you know, in South Beach that is well protected, wind resistant, and is much more or less susceptible to, you know, wind events and certainly flooding unless it's on the ground floor. And the insurance policy should reflect that. Not only in the pricing, but the coverage. You know, do you need wind coverage and hurricane coverage in Florida if you're going to move your entire collection to Crozier, you know, during wind season? No, probably not. You don't need to pay for that. And, it, you know, that will make a meaningful impact on the price itself. But there's other things when you look at the actual insurance policy and the risk itself that you can very much customize and tweak that will right-size the program so that you're paying for what you need, not more or not less. And, like, that's really important, because if you got someone, again, who just goes through the exact same process and, you know, the traditional insurance, here's the information, Mr. Carrier, please give me a quote, you're just going to be getting something that's not really driving value for your collection.
Hmm. It is really – it kind of points to this idea that essentially if you're in an area like that or you're facing those kinds of circumstances, that it's like, what can you do to protect the collection that's going to help offset exposure to risk generally. So you mentioned wind, those kinds of things. So, of course, we saw the famous, you know, example of the Getty in L.A., which had these incredible fire protection systems for that, and which I would presume had a very strong effect on the insurance policies that we look at as well.
Absolutely. I think we always focus on controlling the controllable. I mean, we could, you know, talk about how bad it is to have a collection, you know, located in Florida in certain arts or California. I mean, it's not controllable. Collections there, we need to accept that and really focus on what we can do to mitigate the risk. And then what we can't fully mitigate, transfer to the insurance marketplace via an insurance policy. Mm-hmm. And so, the Getty, while I can't speak to their insurance program specifically, you know, they may feel that with all the protections they have in place, they don't need wildfire coverage. I mean, or that, you know, maybe they're buying it in addition to what they're doing. But I think being strategic and looking at what you're doing, and does that eliminate or minimize the risk? And then if it doesn't fully eliminate it, or you're not comfortable with, you know, it being completely eliminated, you know, the insurance policies are always there. The insurance pricing will definitely, it should reflect if your insurance broker is telling your story to the insurance marketplace the right way. You know, the pricing is going to reflect what you're doing to protect the items. I mean, you know, there's certain storage facilities and packers and shippers that will offer on a retainer a guarantee that they will come get the items in both Florida and California. And the cost of that may save you more than enough money to actually pay for it on your insurance policy once you tell your insurance carrier. And so it's about being strategic and looking at all your options and not just assuming that, hey, listen, if I do this, like, this will be fine. Or if I have this insurance policy, it's going to be fine if I don't, and I don't need to do anything to actually safeguard my collection. The insurance carriers do expect to some extent that, like, certain things are done to actually protect the collection just in order to get insurance. And they're expecting that the collector do that, not, hey, listen, you're not going to have to do anything. We'll just insure you.
That's great. So, all right, let's think about a little bit, you know, collectors and collections at the higher end of the value range. I'm kind of curious to hear from you maybe examples or circumstances you've come across of more exotic or unique policies that are accommodative to collectors. You know, you start to reach that $100 million plus collection, that type of range. You know, what are things that are presented to them from the policy standpoint that might be a little bit unique?
Absolutely. I mean, the more the value, the more creative you can get in terms of the insurance policy structure and the coverages that you want versus don't want. And you have the ability that, you know, because the risk is so substantial in so many different areas with a large and active collection that, you know, you can kind of pick out parts of the insurance fine art policy that, like, are more attractive, and then, you know, in a way that, like, a smaller mid-sized collector really couldn't. We've seen certain collectors that are not really worried about the risk within their four walls or their home or their storage facilities, but more they're focusing on buying just insurance for the items that they have on loan and consignment. Or conversely, if there's a private dealer or museum, we've seen them, a museum, just buy items for the just buy insurance for the items they have on loan from others and not buy insurance for their own permanent own collection. And so there's, like, flexibility and customization there in a way, at, you know, especially for larger enterprises and collectors, it just doesn't happen on, you know, on a smaller level. And I mean, we've seen plenty of things. I mean, we've seen collectors who, they don't want loss in value. They just want coverage for restoration and conservation costs. They're not really worried about that. Or certain, you know, specific perils only if the value is, you know, large enough that, like, the premium is going to be significantly different between buying your typical very broad fine art insurance policy versus, like, I'm just buying it for earthquake. It's the only thing I'm worried about in California. And being very intentional about their risk management strategy and program. I mean, I think that a lot of people would buy it just for their kids, you know, if that product was available. But ultimately, there's certain things that, based on personal experience, some collectors are just more concerned about, even if it's not, you know, the type of risk that maybe we would think of, you know, at the beginning of, a fact-finding discussion with a collector. But, like, we respond to our clients. We listen. And, you know, like I said, peace of mind is important. And so if that's what they're worried about, you know, we'll find something for them.
So what if you're, insuring as – you're considering insuring as an individual, so there's – right, so you own the artwork as an individual, as a family, versus if the artwork is owned in a trust, a structure, or if there's an LLC, you know, that owns the artwork, how should those – does that affect how a collector would think about the insurance policy?
I mean, it shouldn't. In theory, the risk, the underlying risk, is really what should drive both the policy itself, the right policy, and the pricing and the structure, limit, and deductibles. You do see some insurance carriers, more on the homeowner side, who also insure fine art, get kind of tripped up with the whole LLC, trust, estate structure, you know, and when they own artwork, and asking a lot of questions. And re-underwriting, but the most, if not all, the fine art specialty carriers, there's going to be no differentiation just based on whether an entity or individual owns the item, but more what is that entity or individual doing with the item and where is it and how are they protecting it. But like there should be no difference between an LLC or an individual if the risk is still the same.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. So what about for like art-backed loans? I was curious to hear about the role that you see of a fine art insurance policy when art is being used as collateral for that.
Yeah, I mean the the art lending space has driven a lot of clients back to the art insurance marketplace, as it's often, if not always, a requirement of the loan that the collector also purchase fine art insurance, to protect the lender's interests. And so it's been incredibly important. It's become, from the last 5 to 10 years, very, very critical to the fine art insurance program of, anyone taking, loans themselves, is making sure that the insurance is compliant with the lender requirements. And so there's a number of kind of table stake requirements from an insurance perspective that we normally see with lenders, and we anticipate those, at all times. And then depending on the lender, the nature of the loan, and some other factors that may be very specific to this collection or loan, there's some unique items thrown into the requirements that we want to make sure that we have the flexibility to respond to. And I mean, we're always willing and able to work with anybody to get what they need so they're not, in breach of their loan documents. It's a matter of, does this make sense? When the loan agreement was put in place, was anybody actually looking at the insurance requirements, which often can get skipped in the process? The loan, gets put in place and then they're using antiquated or probably not right size insurance requirements for the specific situation. But ultimately, it's important. I mean, because the lenders require it, and folks are continuing to take out, collateralize their art collections.
So, what would be some of those table stakes requirements for the lender might have?
Yeah. So, one of the probably most important thing that they're going to want is to be added in, their interest to be added into the policy, as loss payee, so that they receive the portion of a claim that covers the outstanding loan amount, in the event of a loss. And beyond that, when we talked about going back to scheduled value versus an agreed value versus the blanket format, they're going to want that scheduled value. While the collector may or may not value the certainty you get with the scheduled value versus having a more blanket, program where, the value is determined at the time of loss, the lender really values the certainty of scheduled value because, as a lender, they're trying to eliminate all risk and then accept the credit risk, really. And so the insurance risk and physical loss risk, to the extent they can get rid of it, they will. And the scheduled value is in part of that.
That's terrific. Well, Brad, I think we've covered a lot of ground here. We could go on and on. There's so many fascinating things to talk about. Maybe as kind of a closing thought or something like this, and you can tell me if you feel this is an appropriate place to go, but I'm curious, any stories you might have seen of just things that, just to kind of put in people's heads, what are some of the loss possibilities that are out there? Some of the kind of maybe one of the crazier circumstances that have happened.
Oh, I mean, we've seen what we expect to see, and then we've seen some things we did not expect to see. Obviously we take client confidentiality and privacy very seriously. And so, it's tough to give the most extreme examples, but, we work with a really large institution, for instance, that when the U.S. was withdrawing from Afghanistan, we got a call from them on a Saturday afternoon, actually. And they said, hey, we need coverage while we get our items out of Kabul. And we've got the federal government, the U.S. Army, they're ready to escort the items, but we need to make sure our insurance applies. Well, you've got items in Afghanistan was our first question. But after that, we worked, basically very quickly, and, given our expertise in the area, we've got some certain rights and responsibilities with insurance carriers that gives us the ability to grant coverage quickly. We were able to get something in place so they could move those items to the airport to make sure that they got out of there. But we didn't expect to have a potential loss from the Taliban, on a collection we were working with, and there we were. And so, I think what we've found is that, art is meant to, our clients are really passionate about their art collections, and they enjoy it, and they want others to enjoy it. And we want to make sure that we help them do that and protect it at the same time. And sometimes we know about things, sometimes we don't. But either way, we want to make sure that the policy and the program responds as best as possible.
Oh, that's incredible. I have to say I didn't expect that would be the answer to that question. So just really shows the reach that the insurance brokers and carriers are having to go to help with that. So, Brad, again, I want to thank you very, very much for being here today, for sharing your insights. I think we all leave a little bit smarter from hearing it. And we look forward to speaking with you again.
Now, thanks for having me. It was great.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.